I have some questions to ask. I'm sure you have some questions to ask also. And let's just get started with a very basic question. Rob, what's it mean to be a Republican in 2016?
It means being confused at times and depressed at times, but always, to me, committed to the core principles that brought me to the Republican Party to begin with. And what you have to recognize when you're involved in politics the way we all have been is that you have ups and downs. You have times that are unpredictable, which is one of the times we're in right now. So you stay fast, stay true to your core beliefs and your values and principles. And you also recognize that a political party, especially in a country with only two major political parties, is a broad coalition. And so you get a wide variety of views and differences, not usually as wide as we're seeing right now, but you have to accept the fact that you're going to have a lot of diversity within the spectrum your party represents. So I'm just going with the flow at this point and focused very intently on state races and local races.
John Carlson, would you answer that question? What's it mean to be a Republican in this year, 2016?
Well, I'm still the same. Some of the people around me have changed a little bit. But, I think this is maybe the most exciting, unpredictable, and volatile year since at least 1968 for both parties. Both parties. I think that the Democratic Party establishment is under siege from the left, which explains the Bernie Sanders phenomenon. I think that the Republican establishment is under siege from both the right and a populist movement of sorts, epitomized, personified by Donald Trump. What it has resulted in is that two models of governing that have served three administrations are dead this year. Big government conservatism, epitomized by both Bush administrations, is gone. It's history. New World Order, planting democracy in other countries, emphasis on globalization, solving problems from Washington, D.C. with conservative principles, that's not working anymore. That model no longer exists. As for the Democrats, the Bill Clinton model of triangulating between the left wing of his party and the Republicans, that's gone. We heard Hillary Clinton, of all people, running far to the left of her own husband's legacy. If you want to see what I'm talking about, compare the 1996 Democratic platform, midway through the Bill Clinton administration, with the 2016 draft Democratic platform. They are two different parties. So I think for both Democrats and Republicans, Ross, it is a time of change, and the common target appears to be an establishment that's out of touch with working people at the local level, as personified by globalization.
And I want to return to that theme of what's going on with parties in general this year, but Matt Madweller, what does it mean to be a Republican in 2016, particularly when it comes to the presumptive GOP presidential nominee?
Well, I think the principles of the Republican Party are enduring. It's the application to current events that always change and then lead people to ask, well, has the Republican Party fundamentally shifted? It hasn't. Republicans believe in the same fundamental principles that came out of the Enlightenment that we've believed since the founding of the party and with Lincoln. We believe in the primacy of the individual over the collective. We believe in self-responsibility. We believe in free markets, free trade, free people. The idea that government should be limited, that the more powerful government becomes, the more of a threat it is to human liberties. Those things don't change. The world around us changes, right? Globalization, wars, demographic changes, whatever. And so we apply those principles from time to time. But with respect to Trump, I think I agree with much of what John said, is that if you look at the politics of America, we always go through populist spasms every 20 to 30 years. And we have these collective conversations about what's the difference between conservatism and populism. I think the last time we did this was a Ross Perot, right? And we've had it, you know, whether it's William Jennings Bryan on their side or, you know, a Ross Perot on our side. Every 30 years, we have this kind of internal spasm about conservatism versus populism. Sometimes it affects the Republican Party, and sometimes it affects the Democratic Party. And this time, it just happens to be affecting ours.
How about you, Chris? Do you agree this is a spasm of populism? And how does that influence what it means to be a Republican this year, particularly when it comes to the presumptive nominee?
I hope it's a spasm or anything else that describes a temporary and transient event. Look, I want to first of all differentiate between what's happening with the Washington State Republican Party and the National Party. Everything I'm going to say tonight, and I'm not going to sugarcoat this, I think I'm probably more negative than what you've heard so far. I'm incredibly concerned about the future of the party. But here, things are going extremely well. I mean, one of the things of value to have the four of us up here, we've all been around for a long time. And the Washington State Republican Party tore itself apart with some really divisive primaries back in the 1990s. That hasn't happened for a long time. We've been united around Rob McKenna, Dino Rossi, around all of our candidates. We haven't had a lot of difficult primaries. I don't have a serious primary opponent. Bill Bryant doesn't have a serious primary opponent. I think the Republicans in the legislature are doing an excellent job. Both caucuses are politically strong. They have a coherent philosophy in Olympia of trying to deliver services without raising taxes. The things they've done in terms of transportation and lowering higher education tuition, I think, are landmark policy achievements. So it's like best of times and worst of times. At the same time, the national level, what's happened this year with Donald Trump, it's a catastrophe. It's a cataclysm. And I think I hope it is something that's just going to fade and pass. But I think it's an existential threat to the Republican Party, and I'm incredibly concerned. It's very difficult being a Republican running for office right now.
John Carlson, a cataclysm for the Republican Party. Do you agree?
No, I don't. I will say this. I have utterly no idea what is going to happen in November. And the one thing I do know is that nobody else has any idea what's going to happen in November either. Nate Silver, who is, you know, the New York Times pollster for the 2012 presidential race, got it right. In fact, got it right everywhere. Predicted earlier in this election season that Donald Trump had a 5% chance of gaining the Republican nomination. And some of the same people who said that he had no chance of getting the Republican nomination are saying he has no chance of being elected.
Nate Silver today, by the way, upped that to 20% chance of being elected president.
No. Getting the nomination. Yeah. No, he said he had a 5% chance of being the nominee.
Today, Nate Silver predicts he has a 20% chance of being elected president.
Wow. Okay. He's trending. Huh? Anyway, but it's to me, you know, this is a debate that has needed to happen in both parties for a while. We just have in this country, and again, I think it applies to both parties, and I think the Democrats are actually in tougher shape in the long run than the Republicans are, which I'll get into later. This conversation about the disconnect, not so much between left and right, that's always there. Republicans and Democrats, that's usually there. But the disconnect between elite America and everyday America.
That's a very interesting point. Rob McKenna, do you agree that Democrats are in worse shape this year because of the divisions within their party than are the Republicans?
Well, I don't know that they're in worse shape this year because they did come into the primaries with three candidates, one of whom never really got traction, Governor O'Malley, former governor of Maryland, two of whom did, one of whom was not expected to. I don't know where Nate Silver put Senator Sanders, but I doubt he accurately forecasted how competitive Sanders would end up being. They had the benefit of having one candidate who managed to, you know, in a small field, you know, go forward and do what people expected her to do, which is to become the nominee. We had a field of 16 candidates that allowed one person with a sliver of the vote to move ahead and be the quote-unquote winner of primaries with a fraction of the vote, creating that phenomenon that, President George H.W. Bush called, Big Mo. The more you win, the more you win, right? It's momentum. And they didn't have that on the Democratic side. I agree with John that in the long run, they're facing some very great difficulties because they got tired of losing in the McGovern era. Bill Clinton dragged them closer to the center. They've been there for a while. Obama started moving to the left. That process has accelerated.
In the short term and November?
Well, in the short term, I think we have the bigger problem because I think it's going to be very hard for Donald Trump to win nationally with the negatives he's piled up among women, among people of color, and among young people. I think I just can't see him overcoming that gap. Yes, he's going to be close. He might be within the margin of error. John McCain was leading Obama at one point in 2008 also. So, you stack that up against the fact that the Democrats in every election since, 2004 have had a lock on the electoral votes to an extent they only needed to pick up, 42 more electoral votes? Matt knows these numbers. They had so many big states supporting California and New York. They were within just a few dozen electoral votes of getting the nomination right out of the box. That problem continues to persist, and Trump has magnified it with his missteps.
Matt, a catastrophe for the Republican Party? And you speak both as a political scientist and as a politician, and your party would certainly like to gain some seats this year. So you can speak to how it might affect politicians in our state.
Well, I think I'll speak as a political scientist. Catastrophe implies a long-term problem. And, people are always writing the obituaries of political parties, and it's never going to happen in a world where there's two political parties. Yeah. When Goldwater lost just horrifically to LBJ in 1964, Richard Nixon was president in 1968, right?
So, and Ronald Reagan became governor of
California, right? We heard about the death of the Democratic Party when the Republican presidents won 5 of 6 elections. People said, the Democratic Party is dead. And then Bill Clinton came along and fundamentally changed the Democratic Party to make it competitive again, right? And so, this too shall pass is, I would say that to any political party where someone like a Paul Krugman is writing their obituary. Now, where it is a catastrophe long term is the effect it will have on the Supreme Court. The person who becomes president of the United States in 2016 will get a 20-year term. Because they will appoint 4 Supreme Court justices, and that will echo through public policy for 2 decades. So that's the catastrophe.
Chris, you wanted to defend your notion that it's a catastrophe in the short term.
Yeah, and the key is what Matt said about this too shall pass. I hope so. I mean, all year long, I have been hearing from people, all cycle long, don't worry, he's not going to win. These polls aren't accurate. Trump is not going to win. Understand how new this is. The Indiana primary was May 2nd. Before that, the conventional wisdom was Ted Cruz was going to win Indiana, win a bunch of these other states, win out here, and nobody can get the delegates. It's going to be a contested convention. Trump will lose there. Until just 2 months ago, all of us Republicans were going around telling each other, Trump can't win, he can't win. The conventional wisdom is he's going to lose this fall, but then he'll go away, he'll go back to running his hotels and stuff, and we'll go back to being normal. I am much more worried than others. I see there's an intellectual movement behind this Trump phenomenon that worries me beyond he himself, which is nativist, isolationist, protectionist. It's what we heard from Pat Buchanan. And if the Republican Party turns and goes down that path, this won't just pass, and the party's going to split.
John Carlson, this is the question I'm asking every Republican I can find. When we look back on this in 5 years and go, 2016, Trump, that was interesting. Or are we going to look back in 5 years and go, that was the year that the Republican Party really fundamentally changed?
Well, Donald Trump ran a really good, with a few dramatic exceptions here and there, primary campaign. He has run a really awful general election up until maybe the last week or so. He seems to be getting his act together a little bit. He needs to make a decision. 3 times in the last half century, someone running for the Republican nomination has challenged the establishment. Okay, it happened with Goldwater in 1964. He was basically trying to wrest control of the party from the Eastern establishment, epitomized by Nelson Rockefeller. And he won the primary, but his attitude was, if you're with me, you're with me. If you're not, I never really thought you would be. He wins six states. Then in 1980, Ronald Reagan runs, and there's a lot of differences between Ronald Reagan and Donald Trump, a lot of differences between those two men. The one similarity is in how their critics in the establishment back in Washington, D.C. reacted to them, which is basically with horror, predicting there's just no way Reagan can win a general election. For crying out loud, he's pro-life, this is a pro-choice party, which it was back in the 1970s and into 1980. He's against the Equal Rights Amendment. He'll lose the suburbs. He'll lose women. There's a gender gap, et cetera, et cetera. Reagan won 44 states. So Trump has to either campaign like Goldwater, which he has been doing, or he needs to transition into campaigning like Reagan, who, like Goldwater, was a philosophical conservative, but who had a very different, more mature view about uniting a party and running as, you know, one strong party going forward. Okay. It's uphill, it's against his nature, but if he does that, then, like I said, I think anything can happen this year.
Let's calibrate. Of all the Republicans in the room, how many support Donald Trump for the presidency? Please raise your hands. Of those of you in the room who are Republicans, who do not support Donald Trump for the presidency, please raise your hands. John, you're neither way?
Oh, I thought you were asking the audience.
No, I was asking everyone.
I'll tell you an interesting anecdote.
But first, okay. To the question, are you supporting Donald Trump for the presidency?
Right. Yeah.
Okay, great. Yeah. Just to calibrate. Now, there are those who are saying that it's a basic fundament of the Republican Party that you support the nominee, and if you don't support the party nominee, you are a rhino, a Republican in name only. So the three of you Republicans on the panel who would be charged as being rhinos, how do you respond to that?
Yeah, I love that. I've been a Republican for 36 years. I was a Republican PCO. I was a Republican member of the House of Representatives. I was a member of the Republican leadership. Rob and I were on the member of the Republican majority of the county council. I was the chairman of the state party, a member of the Republican National Committee. And now I'm a rhino because I don't support somebody who just a few years ago was a registered Democrat. There has to be a line there at some point. You cannot in good conscience support anyone your party would nominate. And for me, my conscience and my principles don't allow me to support somebody who I don't think is qualified to be president, who I fundamentally disagree with on every major issue. And sometimes there's honor in splitting your party. I'm really upset that you have not seen more Republicans do what conscience Whigs did in 1848 when the Whig Party nominated a slaveholder as president. And the Whig Party said, we can't go there. This party is opposed slavery. Or what the two parties both did over currency in the 1896 election, or the Democrats did over civil rights. At some point, you have to say, my party may not always be right, and I have to follow my conscience and my principles. Sometimes splitting is the more honor. There is no honor out there right now in this idea of no matter who we nominate, we have to fall in line. I can't do it, and I won't do it.
Matt, has anyone accused you of being a Republican name only? And if they have, or what's your response?
Not anybody that knows me. What Donald Trump and I have in common is that we're both Republicans, and what we have in difference with one another is that I'm a conservative. I know that I'm a conservative. I believe in the things that I laid out for you at the very beginning. I believe in free markets, free trade, free people, limited government. I don't know what Donald Trump believes. He's been speaking at hundreds of events and lots of debates. I know he wants to build a wall. I know he wants to ban Muslim immigration. But other than that, and I know that he's, basically a protectionist in a way that only a Michigan unionist could appreciate. Those are not my values in the sense that I believe in free markets. I believe in free trade, but he says a lot. He speaks a lot of words, but he doesn't say anything. So I can tell you that after all the Fox News debates, and I watched them all, I still don't know really what the man believes. I don't know if he's pro-choice or pro-life. I don't know how he believes about the minimum wage. I don't know what he believes about what our tax policy should be. All I know is he wants to build a wall, he doesn't like Muslims, and he hates trade.
Rob McKenna, are you a Republican in name only because you will not support the nominee?
I've been called something far worse than that. Far worse. I've been called a Clinton supporter,
Yeah, me too.
Because they say, well, if you don't vote for him, you're voting for Clinton. Well, actually, I think what we're saying is we're abstaining because we don't like either choice. And you have to follow your conscience up ultimately, as Chris has pointed out. I think that Matt made a very important point as well when he talked about the fact that no matter what happens this year, there are two parties in this country. And there's a reason that we haven't had a multi-party system throughout our history. It has to do with the structure of our government, a bicameral legislature. We can get into that. We don't have a parliament. And because we don't have a parliamentary system, we don't have a multi-party system. And we are not going to have a multi-party system. But what this means is that the parties every 30 years or so go through, you know, sometimes pretty wrenching shifts. We saw that in the shift from McGovern to Clinton. We saw that in the shift to Goldwater-Reagan Republicanism. We apparently are seeing a shift away from that this year. And it remains to be seen what comes out of that. But when you only have two parties, the people running them get tired of not being in power after they're out of power for a while, and so they make adjustments. We see this time and again. Again, with Clinton pulling the Democratic Party closer to the center, you're seeing that with Republicans in the 2016 cycle who are trying to make the party relevant to Hispanic voters again, for example. And so that process will happen. The question is whether it happens too slowly to allow us to come back in 4 years or 8 years, or it takes longer than that.
John Carlson, Matt said that Donald Trump is not a conservative. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, he's not. He's a populist, and he doesn't really – he's not anchored to a conservative philosophy in the way, quite frankly, that the four of us are. You know, he wasn't my first choice or third or seventh choice either. But on four key domestic issues, I think he would be hands down better than Hillary Clinton. One is the aforementioned Supreme Court. Donald Trump's list of Supreme Court nominees, should he win, is stellar. It's excellent. Secondly, Obamacare. The Affordable Care Act in the next 4 years is either going to be cemented into the fabric of American government, or it is going to be repealed and replaced. I think Donald Trump would repeal and replace it with whatever comes out of the House of Representatives, and what's coming out of the House is pretty good under Representative Tom Price. On immigration, quite frankly, I think he is right about illegal immigration and about opposing amnesty, and frankly, yes, about building a wall. I tell you what, if we're not going to build a wall, why don't we just take down what we have in place now? Because what we have in place now, oftentimes for hundreds of miles, is a joke. You know, do we have a border, and are we going to fortify and protect the border, or are we not? And fourth, the tax code. Are we going to change the tax code in this country to create jobs? Are we going to grow the economy, or are we going to change the tax code to grow the government? On those four key issues, where the next 4 years are vital, Donald Trump is on the right side of all those four issues. That's enough for me.
Chris Vance, there's no common ground. We just heard John Carlson talk about common ground he felt and reasons to support Donald Trump.
I think he probably would appoint better justices than Hillary Clinton would. I think he probably would sign legislation that the Republicans would pass on Obamacare. I agree with that. I agree that we need better border security. I actually don't know anybody who doesn't agree with that. We've got to seal our border. You don't have an immigration policy if you can't control who's entering and leaving the country.
Hillary Clinton
right about the wall?
Well,
is he right about the wall?
It's not a wall, but we need about another 700 miles of fencing. We need to hire about another 20,000 border guards. In 2013, the U.S. Senate passed a bipartisan bill that had everything that conservatives have ever wanted in terms of border security, but it was paired with giving a path to legality for those who are here, and that's why it couldn't pass the U.S. House. But there's a general consensus you need to do border security. I disagree with John dramatically on economic policy. It's one of the I was the co-chair in this state of an organization called Fix the Debt. I'm a huge supporter of a Simpson-Bowles-style solution to bring our debt down. We're $19 trillion in debt. Donald Trump would add $12 trillion to that because he wants to cut taxes 20%. but he's the only Republican who is absolutely opposed to any sort of entitlement reform. He thinks the rest of us are crazy for talking about trying to reform Social Security and Medicare. So he would drive our debt up even higher. And I think we, along with his policies that are anti-trade, would drive us into a huge recession. So there is common ground, but not nearly enough.
Matt, you didn't seem to be able to figure out where Trump was on things, and yet John sees these 4 points on which he can support. What do you say?
Oh, yeah. I mean, not a large disagreement with what John said. He identified about three of the things that I had mentioned as well. So, we live in a world where political parties are not monolithic. They're coalitions, right? Whether you call it the Sun Belt Coalition that Reagan put together or a Rainbow Coalition, right? But political parties are never about 51%. They're really about finding fives and tens to get to 51%. And there's always some overlap. It's like those little Venn diagrams you made when you were in high school, right? So.
Well, my question, and I'll throw it to Rob first, is do political parties even matter anymore? Jonathan Rauch's cover story was How American Politics Went Insane. Mm-hmm. And his line was, the political parties no longer have either intelligible boundaries or enforceable norms. And as a result, renegade political behavior pays, i.e. Trump, i.e. Bernie Sanders. What do you have to say to that, Rob?
Yeah, I think there's something to that. When I was reading a biography of Franklin Delano Roosevelt, I was struck by the remarkable diversity in the Democratic Party of the 1930s. I mean, it was crazy, the coalition they had. And the Republicans were equally diverse. And it was just so interesting to see that they were considered coherent political parties with wildly disparate views on issues like civil rights, for example, between the Southern Democrats and the Northern Democrats. And yet somehow they functioned better than ours do now. And I do think this is a serious problem, not because the parties are so important per se. I think they're just vehicles for advancing, you know, the political process. But I worry about what the impact has been on the most important branch of our federal government, the Congress, which has become so dysfunctional. And what I notice when I go back there, and I've noticed it happening more and more over the last 20 years, is less and less getting done because Republicans and Democrats are more afraid of their own party than they are of the other party. And they're afraid of being criticized for reaching across the aisle and working with the other party. That wasn't always the case. People knew how to work with each other across party lines to get things done in Congress. And they don't get much done now, in part because they're so afraid of their own potential primary opponent. My point is this. A dysfunctional Congress is the greatest threat to representative democracy that we have, because when Congress gets nothing done in that vacuum, two things happen. More power shifts to the president, the executive branch, to regulators who work for him or her, and more power shifts to the Supreme Court. I think it's disturbing that we put so much emphasis, overly much emphasis, on the Supreme Court and the presidency, but we do that because Congress has become so weak.
Matt, and then Chris.
Yeah, so I think I'm glad you shifted the conversation this direction, because that's really the story of the Trump campaign, is that if I could identify the most undeserving victim of the 2016 primary, it's the establishment, right? The establishment, by which we mean people who are successful, have won, and have actually done the work of governing, have been pillared by both groups in this political system. And the great irony is that you have a Democratic Sanders campaign that is bemoaning the existence of superdelegates, and I am sitting here wishing the Republicans had them, right? Because at the end of the day, I am so sick of hearing, whether it's Ted Cruz or Donald Trump or everybody's go, oh, the establishment let you down. That's baloney, okay? Boehner didn't stand up to Obama. Baloney. Barack Obama has been a lame duck president since the passage of Obamacare. He has accomplished nothing in 6 years because the Republican in Congress stood up to him and wouldn't pass that legislation. But because you have this mob-like mentality that says, well, John Boehner didn't repeal Obamacare. Well, I would say to that mob, please tell me how you repeal Obamacare without the president's signature. There's this disconnect, and we are still suffering, or I guess now we are suffering, from the McGovern reforms of 1968, where he democratized the process and turned over the nomination process to essentially the populist urges of a democratic society. And our society was based on the fundamental principle that we have checks and balances on the mob-like tyranny of the majority, and we've abandoned it within the political parties.
Chris, do the parties no longer have intelligible boundaries or enforceable norms, which has led to this insurgent behavior?
Well, apparently the Republican Party doesn't, because we've allowed ourselves to be hijacked by somebody who doesn't believe in our core principles and who the overwhelming majority of Republican activists don't support. I love that article that you mentioned. I read the whole thing. It was long, and it made some really good points. And America's never been like a parliamentary system where you have to ask permission of the party elders before your name gets on the ballot. We're much more entrepreneurial. Anybody can get their name on the ballot and run for office. Anybody can run. You know, nobody recruited Donald Trump. He ran on his own. But we used to have more tools and more ability for the parties to protect themselves. I was state party chairman for 6 years. And back then, we had rules in place. Actually, I didn't pass them. I inherited these rules. But we had longstanding rules in place that we would not give party support to a candidate who didn't sign a document called the 11th Commandment, that they wouldn't attack their Republican opponents, that they had to demonstrate that they had a history of being a Republican, that they agreed with our platform. And if they didn't agree to those things, we cut them out and did not give them any party support. Where was the RNC months ago? At some point, the RNC should have said, you know, really, I don't really care how many delegates you win or how many votes you get. You cannot be the nominee of this party.
How could they ignore the Republicans who voted?
Because, again, well, we're going to find out at the convention whether or not the party matters. Because the Republican and Democratic parties actually matter. And they're governed by people who've dedicated their lives to the Republican and Democratic parties. And by opening up the process so wide, we've allowed people, you know, someone who was, like I said, a registered Democrat just a few years ago, to now take over one of the two major political parties. I'm afraid it's going to keep on happening. What needs to happen is the two parties need to choose their nominees, and then the American people can decide if they like them or if they want to vote for someone else. But the basic answer to your question is we're reaching the point where the parties are meaningless because they can't control their own message.
When you say the parties have to decide, you're not defining the parties as most of the voters in those parties who voted.
I'm talking about people who are dedicated to the Republican or Democratic parties.
Not someone who just goes in and votes.
That's right.
John Carlson.
Chris, he won fair and square.
Sure, under these rules. I think these rules are insane.
Well, he won because voters voted for him. I didn't vote for him, but the voters voted for the man.
Right.
Donald Trump got just as large a proportion of votes in Republican primaries and caucuses as Mitt Romney. He got a larger proportion of Republican votes in the caucuses and primaries than John McCain did 4 years before that. So, you know, you can complain about the results. Like I said, you and I both had what we thought were better candidates, early on. But the bottom line is the guy won fair and square. And by the way, while we're talking about keeping your word, remember when Donald Trump first ran and he wasn't clear on whether or not he would run as a third party or not? This came up in the first debate, I think. Mm-hmm. Will you sign a pledge to support the nominee? And at first he hedged, and then he said, yes, I will, and he actually called a press conference and signed the pledge. Okay. Look at some of the other candidates like Jeb Bush and Lindsey Graham, as if it matters, but still, on principle, who signed that pledge who aren't supporting the winner. You know, what about honor on their part? Didn't they sign that same pledge that the media made such a big deal about Donald Trump signing, that the party made such a big deal about Donald Trump signing? Well, if it matters for him to do it. Why doesn't it matter for them to do it?
Well, right after the Wisconsin primary, Donald Trump said he wouldn't bind himself against that either way. He broke his pledge.
Finally,
but they never should have made that pledge.
Well, that's what you told the reporter for King. I didn't know he was going to do so well. Mm-hmm. Well, he did. Mm-hmm. And finally, I want to address the point that Rob made. Rob, I think that you actually laid the groundwork for why Trump might be a successful president, and that is the gridlock in Congress. Both parties is really driven by ideology. It's made both caucuses quite rigid. You can argue, really, that the Democratic caucus is afraid of their left flank and the Republican caucus is afraid of their right flank. Maybe the kind of president who could break through that is a consummate deal maker who's not ideological at all and has played in both parties.
Rob McKenna, is the deal maker of The Apprentice going to be the deal maker of between with Congress and with foreign powers? Should he be elected?
I do think he's more likely to try to work with Congress and broker deals. I think that's true. I don't think he's going to win for the reasons I already mentioned. Which breaks my heart because any number of other people who could have been nominated, I think, would be ahead
of
Hillary.
Any of the other 16.
Well, certainly some of them were polling well against her for months, that's for sure. But I think compared to President Obama that he could conceivably do better because he does know how to negotiate. And President Obama couldn't bring himself to negotiate with Republicans in Congress in good faith. They tried. Boehner tried. Ryan has tried. He wouldn't do it. And we shouldn't be surprised that he wouldn't do it because he had no track record of success as a member of the Senate or as an Illinois state legislator. He never accomplished anything of substance in his prior positions. Why would we suddenly expect him to become a brilliant deal maker with Congress a la Reagan or even Clinton, who at least was willing to adopt the agenda of Gingrich for welfare reform and other items to get them done? He got things done because he could work with Congress. But not Obama. So but in contrast to Obama, he'll probably do better. And we certainly need that.
Matt Manweller, why this year, 2016, has Donald Trump's insurgent candidacy been so successful? Some would argue that this is the logical conclusion of a series of actions taken by Republicans over the past 4 or 5 years. But you have a theory about this.
I have an answer, and it's outside what you read in the mainstream media. Everybody is focusing on anger, frustration with the establishment. I have a different take on it. It's probably a little bit more nuanced, and probably a lot of people disagree with it. But I think that Donald Trump is a reaction to the shaming of disagreement. So political debate used to take place in, I believe I'm right, you believe I'm wrong, let's look at the data, let's argue. But political debate has shifted into more of a Hester Prynne, if I disagree with you, I'm going to make you wear a scarlet A on your chest. And then I'm not going to simply disagree with you. I'm going to shame you. I'm going to shame you on Facebook. I'm going to shame you on Twitter. I'm going to silence you with that shame. I'm then going to go after your business. I'm going to convince people. The shaming shifts to shunning, right? And now that I've shamed you, I'm going to try to convince everybody not to go to your restaurant, not to hire you. And so the shaming leads to the silencing of dissent. If people used to disagree with one another, now we say, oh, I'm not going to look at your facts. I'm just going to call you a racist.
So you're saying Donald Trump is the guy who will not
be
shamed?
Well, what I'm saying is that he is shameless. And as a result, let me give you an example.
Or shame-free.
Shame-free, right? I was talking with a woman, and this is serious. She was a rape victim. And she came out opposed to the bathroom rule. She says, I was a rape victim. I'm traumatized by that. I don't want men in my shower. So what was the response? I'll talk to you. Let's talk about data. No, you're a bigot. You're a racist. You're a horrible person. We're going to shame you on Facebook. We're going to shame you with your friends. We're going to go to your boss and tell him what a horrible person you are. So she is silenced, and she says, I don't talk about it. But when you shame people into silence, you don't change their mind. You just create incredible resentment. And that resentment manifests itself in Donald Trump. I can't say I want to build a wall because you'll call me a racist. I can't say I don't want men in my shower because you'll call me a bigot. But I can vote for Donald Trump, and he can say it for me.
John Carlson, what do you think about that theory?
No, I think that that part of the appeal to Donald Trump is that he is aggressively anti-political correctness, that he is taking on the culture of political correctness that I think really is cancerous, particularly in higher education, on some of our most elite campuses in particular, in terms of shunning, to use your term, Matt, free speech, in stifling free expression, in flattening what college campuses are there for, which is free expression and debate. I mean, that's another topic for another day, but we have a serious problem in this country with how political correctness has been used as a cudgel, as a weapon against people expressing themselves, debating, and discussing issues. When I was a student at the UW, we were encouraged to get out of our comfort zone. Now students are expecting a safe space. A safe space. You know, that's what our kids look for in preschool. It's not what colleges and universities are supposed to be about.
Chris, do you agree that Donald Trump's shameless or shame-free personality is a key to his success this year?
Oh, absolutely. Donald Trump's – this phenomenon has happened, I think, for three reasons. One, Donald Trump is Donald Trump. One of the best ways to get elected to any office is start out rich and famous. Okay? Name ID is not a problem. He's a known quantity, and he's really good at what he does. He has tremendous skills at what he does, which is just promotion, branding. Second, is an incredibly crowded primary.
Right. Yeah.
Hillary Clinton would have lost the nomination if there had been 15 Democrats running, I think. I think Bernie Sanders would have carved out his same niche and would have won. Donald Trump won because we had 17 people running, and as Rob said, he was able to pile up victories, winning pluralities. If a few people had gotten out of the race, I think Marco Rubio would have been our nominee. And I think if Marco Rubio hadn't screwed up one debate answer in New Hampshire, he probably would have been the new nominee. Actually, he had momentum at that point. People forget. But the third thing is this entire atmosphere out there of political correctness. I agree with that 1,000%. I'm an adjunct professor at the University of Washington, and I have lived with that. And the stagnant wages, which has led to no economic growth, has made people angry. People want to send a message, and I understand that, but you're actually voting for somebody who's going to actually occupy the office, and you have to look at, is that person qualified? And that's where it falls short.
A question for each of you. What will the impact on the Republican Party be if Donald Trump wins? And what will the impact on the Republican Party be if Donald Trump loses? Rob McKenna?
I don't think we know yet what his impact will be either way. I think if he loses the card-carrying members of the establishment, like all of us and our friends in D.C. and Olympia, will probably breathe a sigh of relief in terms of the party, though not a sigh of relief about having Hillary Clinton as president. But we will, I think there will be a temptation to say, well, this is just a passing phenomenon. This is attributable to the unique characteristics of Donald Trump. And maybe it is. But I think it's too early for us to tell. If he's elected, then I think we'll hope for the best that, as John is predicting, that we hope that he'll be able to work with a Republican-controlled House and hopefully a still Republican-controlled Senate, and that things will get done. But I'm not optimistic that he'll become president because I don't see how he can win with his fairly limited appeal. That the people who are – I hear this from people who come up to me and talk to me about Trump, and they say very frequently what they say to me is, I don't really like him. I don't necessarily agree with everything he says. But you know what? He says things that I think. He says – I can't say it. He says them. I don't think that's a big enough base to win the presidency in 2016. And that's why, to me, the number one job of a party is to nominate someone who can win. The parties don't always succeed in doing that, of course. And look at McGovern, for example, or Goldwater. But that is what we're supposed to be doing because it affects all the races down ballot, and we haven't talked about those yet. But I am concerned about the impact of the Trump candidacy and, if I'm right, his lack of success on down ballot races.
Well, we've seriously underestimated Donald Trump all along. So just as a thought experiment, Matt Manweller, what happens to the party if he wins? What happens to the party if he loses?
Well, I'm one of those people that I don't like Donald Trump, but I don't fear a Donald Trump presidency. I say that for a variety of reasons. If Donald Trump is sworn in as president of the United States, the enormous impact of walking into the Oval Office and accepting the enormity of that job.
It's a huge office.
Oh, yeah. But it will temper him.
I got that.
Anybody who has been on the outside and has run for office in kind of a cavalier way, and the day you put your hand on that Bible and you're looking at this office and you're like, this is now real. The things
this
that I do.
Personality will change.
Right. The things that I do affect millions, if not billions, of people. And that really is the nuclear football. And this is no longer The Apprentice. I think that changes any human being. Second of all, we don't elect, as I will quote Barack Obama, we don't elect a dictator every 4 years. We elect a president that is hemmed in by a Supreme Court and two other branches of government. And just as Barack Obama has been a lame duck for this last 6 years because his early legislation led to a massive takeover of the House and Senate, you know, Donald Trump isn't going to get to build a wall unless the Congress funds a wall. Donald Trump's not going to be able to ban Muslim immigration unless Congress chooses to change the immigration statutes in the United States. So the fact that we don't elect a Democrat, you know, the biggest trouble I ever got in politics, I wrote an article for the Seattle Times, and I said, in the end of the day, it doesn't really matter if George Bush or Al Gore gets elected because your lives fundamentally won't change. You will have the same job you have today. You will have the same religion and be allowed to worship it. You will still be in a capitalist society. You'll still have all of these rights. The reason that democracy and presidents work in the United States is that it doesn't matter if you lose. I hold to that. Democracies only work in countries where it doesn't matter if you lose. Mm-hmm. If it matters where you lose, people pick up a gun and shoot the other side. When you lose in the United States, you go, we lost that one. We'll see you in 4 years. Mm-hmm. That's why I don't fear a Donald Trump presidency.
John, does it matter to the GOP if Trump wins or if Trump loses?
Yeah, well, if he wins, again, the four issues that I talked about, the Supreme Court, Obamacare, immigration, the tax code, I think all get changed for the better. I think Trump wants to matter, so he will be a pragmatist and a deal maker. However, on a couple of issues, I think the Republicans are in, and the country is in, even if the Democrats win, for a very stormy debate, and that is the issue of globalization in general and trade in particular.
How about you, Chris?
Well, first of all, I don't ever expect Donald Trump to change. I mean, people keep waiting for that and hoping for that, and a lot of people keep thinking, you know, well, he's going to change. He's 70 years old. He's been, in his mind, a huge success his whole life. What he's doing is working. Why would he change? And if he wins the election, it's the ultimate validation of what he's been doing. He talked about it. Why should I change if things are winning? I mean, so I don't expect him to change. I do believe that he doesn't have the skills or experience to be president. So one likely outcome is what John talked about, is he will just be there but be driven by what's happening with Congress. Because if he wins, you're probably going to see big Republican majorities in the House and Senate, mm-hmm. which I might enjoy because it might mean I would be there. So I think he'd be driven by what Congress would actually do. I think that's likely. But what I fear maybe the most, winning or losing, is Donald Trump is not – and here a lot of Republicans disagree with me. They like to say, well, you know, there's no intellectual underpinnings to this Trump movement. It's all just whatever comes out of Donald's mouth. I disagree. You listen to the people who are around him, the people who speak at warm-up acts, at his rallies. There is an intellectual underpinning there, which is anti-trade, isolationist foreign policy, nativist, bordering on racist. And those folks are going to say, okay, this is now what the Republican Party is supposed to be about. And whether Trump is around or not, they're going to push for changing our party. And that will, I think, be the end of the modern Reagan Republican Party.
You see, in Great Britain, they didn't have a person on the ballot, they had a policy on the ballot, and that is leaving the European Union, Brexit. And if you were to have Brexit, if we had the Republican candidates lining up on either side, we probably would have had a divided Republican Party on Brexit. We have a Republican Party that is divided today because somebody kind of personifies the case that the leave, the European Union side, had on Brexit. So I'm not, again, this debate is long overdue, and it is was going to happen one way or the other.
Yeah, I agree with that, and I think that this is at the heart of what's going on in both parties, right? I've been thinking all year that on the Democratic side, you've got people who are very unhappy about the impacts of globalization and the downward pressure on the middle class, failure of growth in real income, and they're reacting by supporting Sanders, saying, well, we need more redistribution. Give me more stuff. And on the right, it's reaction against trade, it's reaction against against the establishment, and those folks saying it's not working for me either, but they're coming up with a different prescription, they're listening to a different messenger. But in both cases, the parties are under tremendous pressure to figure out how to lead in a world where America's role has changed, where we no longer enjoy the hegemonic position that we enjoyed in a post-World War II, post-Bretton Woods world. And you know, other countries that we helped rebuild have come up, first Japan and Germany and Europe. More recently, countries like China and Brazil and others. And that's putting tremendous pressure on us as well. You can actually pinpoint the point at which America reached its apex economically in terms of economic dominance to the point at which Japan and Germany really started to take off in the 1970s. So we have both parties are struggling to come up with a formula, because this is a representative government, that will bring back a growth and prosperity, which will bring back the American dream. The American dream really is that my children will be better off than I was, than I've been, and that most Americans have figured out is not the case right now.
Absolutely.
And neither party has figured out how to answer that question or come up with a solution to it.
I've got some more questions, but hopefully you do too, from having heard this wide range of opinions we've heard up here. Do you have questions or something you'd like to share with our panelists? Yes, I'm going to have you come out to the edge here so that because I will hold on to the microphone. Come on out here. Just what's your name and what's your question?
Chuck. Nobody's talked about character. Could you address that? Does character matter? You can talk about both parties, both candidates. Just curious where you are on
Did
that.
I mention I can't vote for either one? Character is a good part of that. You know, I don't think that Hillary is honest. I think she has developed a pattern of lying systematically. And I look at Trump's life, and I think, really, this is the guy that I want to be my president? I mean, Obama is a far more honorable man than Trump is when it comes to character. You look at the loyalty that he's had to his family. You look at his consistency in that regard as a father. Et cetera. But so no, I don't see it. And I think Trump. Now this is my lawyer hat, right? I mean, Trump has been very shrewd at using the bankruptcy code and using litigation as a weapon against other people. He is not the kind of businessman that I think we hold up as a paragon of business ethics, to put it mildly. Trump University is just one example of that.
Yeah, any other comments?
Absolutely. I mean, we as a party were horrified at the behavior of Bill Clinton in office. Imagine Donald Trump in the Oval Office. And the things he's done and said in this campaign. Yeah. My wife is a special education paraeducator. She works with little autistic kids in the Auburn School District. When he mocked that man who had the disability,
yeah,
and he wants to lead the party of Ronald Reagan and Abraham Lincoln, and just we haven't talked about it, but that's disqualifying to me.
John, do you want to defend Donald Trump's character?
You have to compare something with something. Do I think Donald Trump is a flawed guy? Yeah, I do. Ironically, one of the things that actually surprised me in a good way is how close he is to his kids and how his kids appear to have come out. But
you mean turned out, don't you, John?
Turned out, yes, okay. Turned out. That's right. That's a different issue.
Yeah. Yeah.
But, I mean, look who he's running against. The most ethically challenged person in public life. Someone who the latest polls on the race, the Quinnipiac poll and the Rasmussen poll, Hillary's at 42% and 39%. This is someone who has been in public life for 27 years.
Do we grade character on a curve?
So, well, no, I think that's one of the things about Trump is he's a street fighter and he tells it like it is, and he calls her a crook. And you know what? She is. If you're going to call Richard Nixon a crook, you can call Hillary Clinton a crook.
Matt, did you want to weigh in on this?
That's very limited. I think that we have come to an era in American politics where people vote their self-interest, and they have enough information nowadays to know who will support them. I remember a few years ago there was a guy named Blumenthal who was running for the Senate in Connecticut, and he had flat out lied that he was a Vietnam vet. It's like, I was in Vietnam, I was shot at, turned out he'd never left American soil. And at the time I was like, well, his career's over. Next poll that came out, he was up 8 points. Just didn't matter. I mean, the people of Connecticut said, that guy's going to vote to back my union and give me more money and transfer the what I want, and so I just don't care. 4 years ago, we had an auditor in this state that we all knew was an embezzler. I mean, it wasn't even, this man is an embezzler, and you want to make him the auditor. He had a D in front of his name, so everybody in Seattle voted for him. You know, just the character doesn't matter the way it used to.
The jury didn't go along with that.
It should, but that's the reality.
Sir, what's your name and what's your question?
Okay. My name is Tom Coger. I've got tons as somebody that I feel has been driven out of the Republican Party. But the point or the question I'd like to ask is I do believe that a lot of the political discourse has been lowered to a horrible level, and it's primarily the result of people like Rush Limbaugh and John Carlson, Glenn Beck, and any number of people on the left as well. We're not getting good information. We're not getting a good political debate. We're just getting fragments of inflammatory rhetoric for the most part, and they pick up on small points. They manipulate it, blow it completely out of proportion. And as a result, there is no political debate anymore. It's just arguing back and forth, 20-second sound bites, and so you're not getting a good enough information to make a credible decision.
Is our discourse degraded, John?
Well, let me give you a chance to back up what you say. Go ahead and tell all of us what I have done on my show to lower the level of discourse.
To your show.
Well, then you probably shouldn't make
Well, then, how do you know your opinion then?
I used to listen to your show years ago.
Go ahead and then give us an example from back then.
I can't remember that.
So you have no evidence to back up what you say. Well, you came prepared to make a claim. Shouldn't you be prepared to back it up?
And that's what I'm asking you folks to.
Okay. Because those who do listen to my show, first of all, they're better informed. Second of all, we put people who disagree with me to the front of the line because that is exactly what I like. What you're describing is network news, 20-second sound bites. What my show is all about is a conversation. And again, I'm just speaking for myself. I like conversation. I like discussion. I like debate. That's one of the things that concerns me about college campuses. We seem to be moving away from all that. The reason why most leading Democrats appear on my show is because they know they're treated fairly with dignity and respect, but we have a good discussion and a good debate.
So talk radio is what it is. It's been around for a long time. I have been on John's show 1,000 times and every other conservative talk. When I was chairman of the state party, we used talk radio to get our message out to our base. Talk radio is what it is. And it often is a very informative discussion. Sometimes it's not. But what worries me is the fact that the presidential debates this year turned into something unbelievable that we've never seen before. I heard politicians, grown-up United States senators and Donald Trump and others saying things on that stage that I couldn't believe anybody running for office would ever say. And it's got to stop. I mean, yeah. People still need to be statesmen at some point. You have to – I've run for office multiple times. I've held public office. There has got to be some sort of level of decorum in terms of how you conduct yourself. We voters need to enforce that, but don't vote for these people that are so incredibly crass and crude.
Matt Weller, as a political scientist and a politician, do you think that this really gotten too much this year?
Well, I would go back to the original question and disagree with him on the comments about access to information. In many ways, the American voter has access to more information and a plurality of views and analysis than at any other time in our history. When we started, newspapers were owned by political parties, right. And you literally got the Democratic paper or the Republican paper. Mm-hmm. In the 1950s, the news was dominated by three stations all based in New York, right? Now we have literally democracy. democratized information. And I would say that any American can get up and turn on the internet or their iPhone and get access to just a absolute cornucopia of information from all sides. What I will say with respect to the base, you know, I guess the sophomoric debate, and I would turn back to what Rob said earlier, when you have 16 people on the stage, someone like a Scott Walker, who was brilliantly successful, who did everything Republicans have ever asked of a Republican governor, stand up to the union, stand up to the teachers' unions, hold your ground, never, you know, compromise, and win, but he's boring.
Jeff,
right? So you had to figure out a way to get on the post-debate spin with 17 people on the stage, and so being obnoxious was one way to do it. And unfortunately, Rubio, who was one of my guys, realized, you know, I'm going to make fun of your hand size, right, you know, with the obvious illusion, because maybe that'll get me a little bit of press. But 17 people on stage, you had to say something sophomoric to be in the soundbite cycle the next week.
So I
think that Matt's on to something very important about the democratization of information. But what concerns me, not that I want to go back to the era when all the news that we consumed came out of New York either, but what concerns me is that one way people are using that information is they're gravitating to those sources that they think agree with things they already believe in. That's right. It's that big sort you've heard about. So people tend to go to those specialized news sources that confirm what they already believe and give them comfort in that. And that does concern me. Actually, talk radio now is like the long-form journalism. Because you actually can have a long conversation. You can have give and take. Not every talk show host allows people who disagree with them to come on and disagree with them. John does. But still, it's better than what I see on Twitter. I mean, by orders and orders of magnitude. And it's better than what I see on Facebook. And when I see that a lot of people get most of their political news from Facebook now, that's cause for concern, because they're not reading Slate or they're not reading National Review.
Although I've got to say, often it's pointing them to those sources through Facebook.
Yeah,
we have another question.
Point,
what's your name and what's your question?
Hi, I'm Kathleen. And my concern is the Republican Party is not going to survive, because if the majority of the electorate actually votes in Donald Trump, and he's so anti anyone who's not from America or looks like what he thinks an American looks like judges who maybe came from relatives who were from another country, how in the world can those of us who believe in the fairness of every human being given an opportunity, we're not going to stay in this party. I'm not going to support anyone who does stay in this party, because it's just not okay with me. I was born in the 60s, and I just believe every person, no matter what color they are, has the opportunity to work hard and achieve. And to be a judge who's gone to college and gone to law school and worked his way up, and then suddenly you're not going to be considered, you know, capable of making a rational decision and following the law.
I would say that your exit will probably be temporary. I remember, you know, I don't remember, I have studied, in the 1960s, a lot of people, like you said, if those Democrats nominate LBJ in the middle of the Vietnam War, I'm done being a Democrat. And you know what? Many of them were, until McGovern. Right, but you always gravitate home to your base values. So you may exit the Republican Party while Donald Trump is the titular head, but you will probably gravitate back if that's where your moral core is.
And the party's going to move too. So it's a dynamic process, right? So the party listens to what you're saying. I mean, the party is a big organism, because people more than anything want to win, because what's the fun in it if you never get to actually do anything because you're in the minority? And so the parties make adjustments over time. I've used the example of Bill Clinton several times tonight. Ronald Reagan is another example of that. You know, he brought a coalition together in order to win in 1980. And you can pick example after example of after example. Now, the counterexample that people sometimes raise is what happened to the Whig Party in the 1840s. Okay, that happened once in U.S. history, and it involved the worst thing our country has ever done, which was to allow slavery. So I think that's probably it's an outlier. The party's not going away. One last point I haven't made yet tonight, but I think is worth making, is this. Trump's election is not the party changing. It's a lot of voters picking someone who's not establishment. But the party is an organization, and in the long run, it is driven by people who are based on a philosophy, who have values. And there's a debate going on within that party right now, as there has been before. when the John Birchers were trying to, you know, control it, and that, you know, we overcame that. So I think that younger leaders will come up, and I think it'll be people like Marco Rubio. I think it'll be people like Kelly Ayotte and others, and they don't want to be permanently marginalized. They want to win the White House again, and they're going to figure out how to appeal to those communities that currently we are alienating to a significant extent.
Chris Vance wants to.
Yeah, I really want to respond. Rob's right, of course. If Trump is just temporarily the leader of the party and Marco Rubio and Kelly Ayotte are our future, well, then we'll be fine. But I'm not so sanguine about that reality. And, of course, the Republican Party is not going to completely vanish. There will always be a center-right party. But look at the Republican Party today in California, where it is completely irrelevant because California is one of the most ethnically diverse places in the United States, and we've completely alienated not only African Americans but Hispanic Americans to the point where we don't have a candidate running in the United States Senate, an open seat race in the United States Senate, and we couldn't get a candidate in the top two in their top two primary. That's disgraceful. And if I served as chairman of the state party at my very first Republican National Committee meeting, was held in Miami, and you had Karl Rove and the entire Bush team there, and this is back in 2001, talking about how if the Republican Party did not start winning a greater percentage of the vote of non-white voters, we were going to become extinct. And so smart Republicans understand this, but we keep getting off track with statements like Mitt Romney saying we'll make them all self-deport, and now Donald Trump, who's probably set us back 20 years with Hispanic voters. It all depends. If Trump is the future face of the Republican Party, we'll survive. We just won't win very many elections.
We've got another question back here. What's your name, sir?
My name is Luke. My question is getting back to sort of Congress. So first of all, I want to, when you look from the 60s to now, back in the 60s, votes were a lot more bipartisan, and there was a lot of reach across the aisle as far as who would vote in favor and against bills. It wasn't such a stark divide, and you've seen over the past 50 years, it's become very red and blue. And then earlier, one of you, I forget who, mentioned that Congress is becoming very weak, and that is giving more power to executive and judicial. So do you think that maybe the solution is, since the presidency is going to either be Hillary or Trump, or, you know, do you think that there is a solution in reaching across the aisle and finding maybe making Congress more effective, since right now Congress's approval ratings are abysmal?
Yeah.
Do you think that that's important?
Yeah, I think it's hugely important. I'm not predicting it's going to happen right away, unfortunately. One of the reasons is that the courts have allowed redistricting to become a caricature of what was originally intended, and districts are now drawn, as you know, for Congress and other districts as well. In a way that to protect incumbency and divide up the districts among the parties, across the country, depending on which party controls which state. So until I don't think this is going to happen in the near future, but until redistricting is reformed and constitutional principles are reestablished for it, you're going to have too many districts in which no one ever worries about being reelected, or they rarely worry about being reelected, except they worry about a primary. They're not worried about the other side. Too many safe districts. That needs to change. The other thing that needs to happen is that leadership in Congress needs to get together across the aisle and say, as an institution, we need to defend ourselves against overreaching executive power and an overemphasis on the courts. We can't keep – when you've got Congress running the federal courts, suing the president, right? I mean, hello, what's wrong with this picture? You know, there's a reason that Congress is laid out in Article 1 of the U.S. Constitution, it's going to take some legal reforms, but it's also going to take leadership stepping up and saying we have to look at this as Americans, not just as Republicans and Democrats.
Yeah, looking beyond politics and policy to structure,
right.
I think we have a problem in this country: too much power in the executive, not enough in the legislative branch. Too much power in agencies and departments, not enough in the legislative branch. What I would really love to see is a president who was committed to swinging the authority back to Congress when it came to a lot of the decisions that are now being made by bureaucrats of the Environmental Protection Agency.
Or by executive order, John.
Yeah.
Right.
Or by the president via executive order when he can't get a bill through.
Right. I just want to thank our panel, John Carlson, for appearing at another radio station's panel. We appreciate that. Chris Vance, who could be out campaigning tonight and maybe is campaigning.
He's going doorbelling immediately after this.
No.
Matt Madwell, who came over to be with us from Kittitas County, and also, of course, Mr. McKenna. Thank you very much for joining us, and thank you for your attention this evening. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Jess. Cool. Thank you.